I'm Michael Hardin, a grateful recovering alcoholic. You know, the pretty neat thing is after we've been around here for a while, we create a family around us. You know, and we have certain members that become like brothers. And that's what George Smith is to me. He's like a brother. I've known him since he came into the program. He's a good father. And he's been around my son for a long time. I got to tell a cute little story about him and my son. They had went a while not seeing each other, and we was at the movies one night, and they had was behind me, and I was looking to see what kind of movie was showing, and I turned and looked, and I didn't see them, and I looked down, they both was on the ground hugging each other, and they just fell to the ground hugging each other, and that's the kind of man he is. He's that with anybody. He's a good friend, he's a good father, and he's a good productive member of society and a good AA member. With that, I'll give y'all George Smith.
Hey, everybody, I'm George. I'm an alcoholic. First of all, Michael don't quite have that story right. Okay, let me just get that straight. We were not hugging. We were actually wrestling. He was 12 at the time, and he was getting a little big. And 12-year-old, they think they're too big for their britches. And he said something smart to me. And, of course, I just grabbed him. We went down, man. You know what I mean? He looked up. He thought we were hugging. It was a little wrestling match going on. But it was fun. We were laughing and joking. It was a good time. He's a good kid. He's like my son, too. I love the kid to death. First of all, Tom, I wanted to thank Tom for asking me to do this. It's always an honor to have the opportunity to come up and share our stories with other members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I haven't done this in a little while. And I was telling Bill that I normally don't get nervous at all when I get up and speak in front of people. And for some reason, all day today, I kind of had that little nervous little butterfly floating around inside. And I was like, okay, all right, well, we'll get up here. And I know once I get up here, it'll be okay. But I know because y'all a tough group, man. I hear this is a tough group out here, man. So, you know, and plus I heard I'm being recorded tonight. So that's always tough because ain't no telling what's going to come out of my mouth. But anyway, it's really an honor to be here and to have the honor to do this. And I'm just going to kind of, you know, do as everybody has always done to come up here, is, you know, just kind of tell you a little bit of what it was like, you know. And, you know, there'll be a few funny moments in there, but a lot of it was not too funny, you know, back when I was struggling with this disease. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the things that I went through. And then I want to transition a little bit and spend a little bit of time talking about what's happened in recovery for me, and then kind of finish it up with that. So let me start out by saying I'm from South Carolina. Go Gamecocks? No. I'm from Columbia, South Carolina, and I am a Gamecock, of course, because that's where I'm from. So, I mean, you know, but I don't snub that in anybody's face right here because I know what country I'm in, okay? I know I'm in dog country. But anyway, that's where I'm from, and I'm the youngest of two kids. I'm the only boy. I have an older sister. And the one thing I always kind of like to start out with when I tell my story is the fact that, you know, in being in the rooms, I've heard a lot of people come in here and talk about their upbringing and the kind of families they were brought up in and, you know, how crazy it was, alcoholic fathers, alcoholic mothers, or, you know, just a whole lot of alcoholism in their family and that kind of, and destructive behavior. That wasn't my experience. You know, I was quite blessed to have two really good parents. Both of them were educators. My dad was an elementary school principal. My mom was a high school teacher. You know, my whole entire family was a real strong, close-knit type family group. And you know, we spent a lot of time together as families on weekends. You know, every Sunday we would all meet up at my grandmother's house. It was a big deal, you know what I mean? And, And neither one of my parents are alcoholics. Now, I did see my dad get drunk a couple of times. I mean, you know, but I mean, literally two times. Maybe, I mean, I can really only remember one time when I saw him really out of control drunk. And that's not alcoholic. You know what I mean? I didn't, it wasn't like I grew up every day and watched my dad or my mom, you know, sloppy, as one of the guys back in my hometown, he said, snot slinging drunk. I didn't see that. I didn't see that when I was a kid growing up. So that does not, I can't use that as an excuse or a reason even for why I ended up being an alcoholic. You know, it just kind of is what it is. You know what I mean? Now, there's a little bit of alcoholism in my extended family. My mother had a brother who I do remember him never taking a sober breath. I wasn't around him a whole lot. I only saw them on, like, holidays and that kind of thing because he didn't live in the same place I lived, but he died. It killed him. You know, he died at, like, in his early 40s. I think he was around 42 when he died from alcoholism. Alcohol killed him. And then my dad had a brother that he told me the story. I never saw him drunk. He told me the story about him being a hardcore alcoholic, drinking, like, rubbing alcohol. You know, yeah, I mean, you know, but I never saw it. But he stopped drinking when he was, I guess, fairly young and never picked it up again. Didn't go to the program. Never used the program. He just never drank again. And he was very successful. He was a family court judge in Greenville, South Carolina, and all that. So the point I make behind all that is that I was not exposed to that kind of life as a kid growing up. So me becoming an alcoholic, I think, from what I understand about who I am today and this disease and being around this program a long time, I'm just one of those people that's predisposed. And I know that because, you know, my whole childhood was up until when I took my first drink was, I mean, I was a good student, man. I was making good grades in school. I wasn't really, you know, out of control kid, none of that kind of stuff. I mean, that wasn't who I was, you know. And then in high school, I was in high school at Columbia High School in my hometown, and I was doing good in school, involved in sports and academics and everything. And my junior year is when I had that first drink. My first cousin, we were all kind of hanging out together, and he said, "Here." And he handed they were all drinking beer, and he handed me a beer. And they were also doing some other little things too, you know. And so I, you know, that was my first exposure to any mind or mood altering substance. And y'all, you know, when you talk about it, I know if you're, you know, an alcoholic and an addict can identify with this. It was like New Year's Eve, like 4th of July, man. I mean, it was like fireworks, you know, the sounds, man. I mean, it was just like, wow, you know, and it was a definitive shift in my behavior from that exact moment right there. My attention to academics just completely went off the charts. I mean, you know, I just didn't even really, you know, I mean, I was still doing it. I was still going to school and I was, you know, still doing my work in school, but I just didn't care as much anymore. My mind immediately went to, I want to do that. That's what I like, man. That's what I like doing right there. And it showed because, you know, me and some of my cousins, I had one cousin I was in particular close to, and, you know, we started doing things like cutting school and, you know, hanging out in the morning instead of, because we used to be able to drive to school back in those days. That was kind of a big deal if you drove to school. And he and I rode together in a car to school. He would drive and I'd drive sometime. And, you know, instead of going to school, we would kind of go park somewhere and, you know, and do our little thing in the morning. And then we'd show up at school late, but then, you know, have to make up a lie why we're late. Oh, you know, the car ran out of gas. And I mean, you know, all that's insanity. You know, that's the start. That was the start of it all right there. And I point that out because you got to understand in my family, y'all, it was like everybody I mean, I'm talking about pretty much everybody was kind of expected to go to college. And I mean, you know, that my whole family was educated people. I mean, you know, everybody got degrees and had degrees and was in education. There was a lot of educators in my family, y'all. You know, I mean, everybody was a teacher, a principal, or a librarian, or something. You know what I mean? And so it was just kind of, a understood thing that, you know, it wasn't even up for debate. You're going to college. But y'all, I tell you, I didn't really care anymore. I really didn't want to. And I remember when I got close to graduation, you know, there was this whole decision about where am I going to go to school. You know, obviously I didn't care about whether I went, but I knew I had to go. And I had a lot, because I had done really good in school, even up to that point where I started drinking, and there was a slight drop off. I had real good grades and was a national merit semifinalist and all that kind of good stuff. And I was getting letters from schools often, you know, to come to them. And I picked this one school up in Knoxville, Tennessee, a little small little school, probably 1,000 students, called Knoxville College. And here's why I chose that school. I chose that school because they were the only ones that offered me a full ride. They offered me a full scholarship. And I wasn't thinking that I'm saving my mom and dad money. I'm thinking, hey, if they're paying for my education, my mom and dad, they're not paying anything, so I ain't got to answer to nothing. I'm on my own now. I'm grown. You know what I'm saying? That was my mindset. I mean, you get where I'm coming from? I mean, it wasn't that I'm going there because it's a good school and I know I'll get a good education there, and you know, and it's financially the right decision to make. It's because I don't have to be under their thumb no more. I can do what I want to do. And obviously, I didn't do much when I got up there academically. I mean, you know, all I did was I found some people like me, and we drank and smoked and all that good stuff, man. And next thing you know, I'm flunking out, and I don't care. I mean, you know, and that kind of started my life for the next, I'm 18 or 19 around that time. That started my life for the next, I don't know, 8 years maybe of just bumping around, you know, no direction, you know, just out of control, man. You know what I mean? It was all about partying. That's all it was about, was partying, hanging out at the bars every night, getting drunk, you know what I mean, and all the other stuff that goes with that. When I got in my mid-20s, I guess a little bit of my conscience started to kick me in the rear end a little bit, and I thought, you know, man, and I'll give you the reason why it happened like this, because I was working at this, I used to work at a dairy, and I was the pasteurizer. And I worked the midnight shift. I worked the graveyard shift. And I hated it. But I worked the graveyard shift. And the guy that was my supervisor, he was just a layman type guy. You know, he didn't have no education either. You know what I mean? And I remember one day thinking, man, you know, I'm smarter than this dude. Man, I got this dude telling me what to do, man. You know what I mean? I don't need him telling me what to do. You know, that's part of that, you know, that selfish, self-centered thinking and all that kind of stuff that was going on already. And I made a decision. I said, you know what, I'm going to go back and get my degree. You know what I mean? Because I ain't going to be working for these people that don't have as much intelligence as I do. And I thought I was, you know, I thought I had it all going on, man. And so I decided I was going to try to go back and get my degree. And I talked to my mom and dad. They said, yeah, we'll help you. And so I went to this college in Columbia called Benedict College. And it's amazing. I still today am amazed at how an alcoholic and an addict of my type can just kind of, for a short period of time, just kind of shut it off long enough. You know, when we make up our minds to do something, you can't stop us, man. If we really make up our mind to do it, you can't stop us. And it could be good or it could be bad. It could be one or the other. But when we make up our minds, you can't stop us. And I made up my mind I was going to do this. My motivation, of course, was because I don't want to be underneath anybody telling me what to do. And I mean, I get my degree, then I can, you know, I can be my own kind of person and whatever, and I won't have to listen to that, you know. But I went there and I was able to, And I was already kind of really way out of control. I was doing a lot of other things other than drinking. And let me say this real quick because, you know, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I have the utmost respect for this program. This program saved my life. I believe in the traditions and the principles, in particular the traditions of this program, and I know we have a singleness of purpose here. And so, you know, I'm always respectful of that, and I try whenever I share to keep, you know, any conversation about drug use or anything like that to a very much a minimum out of respect for AA. But I have to share some things so you really know who I am. So, you know, I just wanted to say that, you know, out publicly because that's a real big deal to me. But anyway, I was doing a lot of things, man, and really way out of control with it all. But when I went to school, I kind of cut all that out. You know what I mean? I kind of cut all that out. I might have had a beer here, a beer there, or a little joint there, a little joint there. But I was going to school, and I was doing my work. And I finished college in 3 years. I went year-round. I went summers and every session and was done and got my degree in computer science in 3 years. Now, here we go. So it's time to go get a job. And I got a good degree. I got a bachelor's in computer science, which at that time, you know, was a really good degree to have. Jobs were plentiful at that time, and I got offered to come work for the federal government up in D.C. For the Census Bureau. And let me back up 1 second a little bit, because before all this happened, I had already had a run-in with the law. You know, during my drinking and drugging, you know, we did a lot of stupid things, and I got caught with a little thing, you know, something, and I had a little record, okay? So I go to work for the Census Bureau, and the way they did it was weird, because the way they did it, you know, I went to work for them, and I applied all that, whatever, but it never came up about whether I had any convictions or not, you know? And I thought, well, that's good. I just kind of slipped under the radar there, you know what I mean? About a year after I was there, my supervisor came to me and said, George, we need to have a little talk. I said, okay, what's going on? And he said, well, I need you to go down to HR, you know, and talk to them down there. So I got down to HR, and they said, well, we just concluded our background check of you. It took a year. I'm like, man, really? I mean, y'all let me work for y'all for a year, and then you gonna come to me with this? But it was a year later, and they called and said, "Yeah, we did our background check showed a little something there." You know, they didn't fire me. You know, they said, but you know, it was under some kind of youthful offender act, which meant it wasn't a hugely bad deal. And they said, if you could just prove to us that it was under a certain such a conditions, you know, we'll keep you on. You know, and I remember y'all coming back from that meeting and going back to my office, to my desk, and I was pissed. I'm thinking, how dare they? You know, I've been working for y'all for a year, and you're going to bring this up now? I don't know if y'all get that now, but that's insane thinking, y'all. That's some insane thinking. They just already told me that we're going to keep you. But, yeah, I'm insulted because they found out something about me that was true. And I didn't even tell them, much less I didn't tell them about it. They had to find out about it behind my back, you know. But I was insulted. And guess what I did? I quit. I quit. How dare y'all? That'll show you, you know. But that's the first sign of some serious alcoholic insane thinking right there, you know. I'm a victim. I'm victimized, you know. So, of course, being in Washington, D.C. is probably one of the worst places to be at that time, what was going on with me. And so I got involved in a lot of, you know, bad activity. I was going back and forth to New York City, you know, taking some guys back and forth, doing some things that I shouldn't have been doing. And, you know, I was lucky I didn't get killed a lot of times. You know, I mean, I was in situations where there was guns and all kind of insane stuff, y'all. And I've actually had guns put at my head before. You know, thinking this is it, they're going to pull the trigger and I'm dead, you know, and they didn't, you know, for whatever reason, you know, somebody said, put it, don't do it, whatever, you know what I mean? And so I went through all of that stuff, you know, and then I came back home South Carolina, and started working down there again. Income, I could always get a job. My dad used to say, "Boy, you can always get a job." You know, and that's one thing about me is I'm not a lazy person. That's one thing I can say about me. I've never been a lazy person. I mean, even today, I work, man. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm probably approaching an age where a lot of people might consider retirement. Man, I ain't retiring no way. I got a 6-year-old daughter, y'all. I can't damn retire. You know what I'm saying? Shoot, I got to work, man, but I mean, I would get a job, no problem, and I was getting these good computer jobs and stuff, but I never could keep them. I never could keep a job, man, because, I was either doing things like, I did the typical, you get the check on Friday, and I get some nice, in that industry, I was getting paid some nice salaries, man. I get these big checks on Friday, and they may not see me till next Tuesday, because Monday I can't make it. You know what I mean? And then all the money's gone, over the weekend. That was just a vicious cycle over and over and over and over again. I lived that. That's how I was living. And then I got a call from a headhunter. In St. Louis, Missouri, it was Southwestern Bell Yellow Pages. They had come across my resume. I don't even know how it got out there, but they had come across my resume and they were interested in talking to me about a job out there. And they wanted to fly me out and meet with me. I was like, wow, really? Okay, cool. And so I went out there, interviewed, and they made an offer to me, and I came back home and I remember this very clearly. Because y'all got to keep in mind that I'm living at home with my parents, because I'm spending all my money on other things, so I can't afford to have my own place, which I could afford it, but what I was doing, I couldn't afford it, and I remember, I said, "Dad, I got this job in St. Louis." And he told me, I remember him telling me, he said, "Don't go." He said, "Don't go." And I don't know to this day why he even said that, but he said it. My dad was a very wise man. He's my dad's dead and gone. God bless you. But my dad, I used to think he'd say some of the stupidest things, but now looking back, he said some of the most wise things to me. He told me, "Don't go." And I said, "I'm going. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm going, man. This is a great opportunity. I get to get away from here where I got all this trouble. If I just get away from here, everything will be all right." Y'all ever heard that before? Y'all know anything about that? That geographical, if I just get away from here, away from these people, man, I'll be all right. So I go to St. Louis and it started out okay, but of course, you know the deal, man. I mean, I'm an alcoholic, y'all. I mean, it is who I am and an addict. And it wasn't long after I got out there before I started getting hooked up with some of the wrong people. And I give you this one little story. I will share this one little story with you because one of my drugs of choice, of course, is cocaine. And I used to be involved. I used to get involved in freebase and stuff like that. And I was out there one day at my apartment, and I was working, and I was reading the newspaper. And on the front page of the newspaper, there was an article about this section of St. Louis where it was like supposed to be a really bad drug infested area. Now you think about somebody who's had a problem with this, you would try to stay the hell away from that, right? Well, no, they even had a map showing the area. I tore that page out and used that map, got in my car and went straight over there, and y'all know the rest of the story. That's insanity. Insanity. Okay, and I started doing that, and of course I lost my job. By the way, this is when I first got introduced to AA. My boss, they of course the people at my job started noticing some things just ain't right with this guy. And my boss called me in one day, my big boss. He called me in his office one day and he said, and he was a really nice guy. He had a real nice heart to heart talk with me. He said, "I got a daughter that's got a problem." "We know you got a problem, and I'd like to see you get some help. Here's what I would like to, suggest you do." And my mind thought was, okay, I'll do anything to keep my job. At that point, y'all, the first introduction to AA, I had no thought or desire of getting clean and sober. Not even an inkling. I went to this little 2-week outpatient program that they put me in, and just kind of cruised through that for 2 weeks. And on graduation day, I promptly went out and celebrated and got drunk. I just go to show you that how much I really, really meant, that I was ready to get sober or whatever. And I mean, that's once again insanity. So that didn't work. And then, of course, I ended up losing that job. And, you know, I started just running around out in St. Louis, doing a lot of stuff, breaking the law again, got caught, started getting locked up on a regular basis out there. And I remember my mom and dad said, you know, I said, man, I need to get out of here, y'all. And they was like, well, the only way we'll help you get out of there is if we have somebody take you to the plane, put you on the plane, and then somebody will meet you here, get you off the plane, and take you straight to this treatment center. It was a 28-day program in Lancaster, South Carolina. I went there, and y'all, I gotta admit, this is probably the first time. It was a 28-day program. This was probably the first time I started to get a little taste of wanting to get sober. You know, I finished the program. And was really excited, getting ready to come out. Well, here's another one of those moments. You know, the day or so before I was about to get released, my counselor called me in and said, George, we got a little problem. I'm like, what? St. Louis County wants you. All that legal stuff that I had going on out there didn't go away. You know, they still had, you know, some stuff that was unresolved. And they had a fugitive warrant on me. And they was like, well, hold, you know, we'll do everything we can, try to see if we can work it out, but, you know, I just want you to know that this is what's going on. So on the day of graduation, everybody else's family's coming to get them, and, you know, everybody's hugging and, you know, just so happy to be graduating. And the people that came and got me were in black and white with blue lights on top. And I can't tell you how demoralized I felt. But, I mean, I knew that I had to, you know, I had to pay the piper, man. You know what I mean? And I'll never forget this. This is one, you know, I have a lot of respect for police officers, y'all. I mean, you know, I know there's some bad ones out there, but, you know, police officers really do a fantastic job serving us out here. I mean, you know, and this one particular police officer in that day that picked me up, when he got me in the police car, he took the handcuffs off of me. And he said, you know, he said, you must have been trying to do something different. You know what I mean? He said, I'm not gonna make you. He had to put him back on once we got to the jail, of course. But he was really, really nice. He talked to me. And that made me feel a little bit better. But anyway, I finally dealt with all that stuff and got sober and got all that resolved, got some probation off of all that or whatever. And then so I'm back in Columbia, South Carolina, and I'm starting to go to meetings, and I'm really getting involved in the program. And I was able to stay sober for almost the next 5 years. And then I was in a little business with some guys, and these guys were in the program. Really nice guys, good guys, man, but they weren't in the program and they partied. You know, and I used to have to travel from Columbia to Virginia Beach where they were, you know, on business with them and stuff like that. And I was good for a while. You know what I mean? I didn't drink. They went out, when they went out, I would just have Coke or whatever, you know what I mean? It was cool. But on this one New Year's weekend, you know, they were all going to go up to the Outer Banks of North Carolina to this nice house to bring in the New Year's. And I thought, okay, I'll meet y'all up there, no problem. And so I go up there, and the minute I get there, you know, most everybody's is coupled off, you know, and I'm by myself. And the minute I walk in, there she is. I mean, she was nice too, man. I mean, you know, and I'm like, wow. And it was kind of like, it was looked like there was going to be a connection there. You know what I mean? And as the night progressed on New Year's Eve, everybody started doing shots, you know, body shots. Y'all know how seductive that sounds, right? So everybody starts doing body shots. Well, I had no defense at that moment, y'all. I mean, you know, and plus, you know, I want to get with her. You know what I mean? So I got to get right in with everybody else. So I started doing them too. Now here's the insanity again. Talk about some insanity. The alcoholic that I am, I didn't just have a couple of shots. I was slamming them. Next thing you know, I'm not slinging drunk. I mean, I'm so drunk that I almost don't even really know where I am. So any chance I did have to get with her, lost all that because I passed out drunk. Alcoholic, man. Alcoholic. Well, I remember coming back to Columbia, and I remember that, and this is part of some dishonesty because I didn't, you know, I didn't want to tell the people back in my home group and everything that I had relapsed, man, you know. So I started going to meetings and kind of pretend like everything was okay, you know. I had nothing happen, you know, and that lasted for just a short period of time because obviously now and there's a part of the big book. I want to touch on this real quick. And I'm going to get out of those stories here in a minute here and kind of get into the recovery part. But I'm going to touch on this a minute. One of the things that I did this last time coming through the program, my sponsor, I came in completely willing to do whatever it took. I knew that the way I was trying to do things did not work. It was clear. So, you know, I came in with a willingness like I never had before. I said, you know, I don't care. I always thought I was smart. It makes a lot of stuff people ask me to do. I was like, that doesn't make sense. But it didn't matter this time for me, the last time I came through. And I've been sober ever since then. But my sponsor asked me to read the doctor's opinion for 30 days in a row. I thought that was the stupidest thing in the world. Why I got to read it 30 days? I could read it in 2 or 3 days and I got it. But I did it anyway. And, you know, one of the things they talked about in the doctor's opinion was the physical allergy, you know, and the mental obsession. And that physical allergy is what I have, and that's what the alcoholic that I might understand and has, is that the minute I put any substance in my body, there's no stopping. It's not having a couple. There's no having one. You know what I mean? It's like, and that's what happened that night at that New Year's Eve party. You know what I mean? I hadn't had a drink in almost 5 years. And then that one night, I went from one shot to just tore up drunk, you know, passing out drunk, you know. So anyway, I came back to Columbia and I tried to pretend like I was still sober, but that didn't work because now I'm drinking every day, but I'm trying to hide it. And it just progressively got worse and worse and worse. And the next thing you know, I'm back in some more legal trouble again. You know, and the only way that the law that in South Carolina they were going to let, they said if you go to this long-term treatment center, if you complete it successfully, we'll drop the charges. I'm like, oh, yeah, that sounds like a deal to me. And I said, how long is it? They said, well, it's minimum 30 days. I mean, 90 days. I said, oh, I can do that standing on my head, man. You know, I mean, I'm thinking, I mean, I done sat in jail for a few times. I'm like, 90 days? Oh, yeah. I could do that one, man. So I went up to a place called Lena Lodge in New Jersey. It is the treatment center for the hardest of the hardcore. I'm here to tell you, it's a long term treatment center. And what I found, the first thing I found when I got up there was that it wasn't just 90 days; it was a minimum of 90 days, but it was open ended, which means you don't leave until they say you can leave. And I still didn't think much of that until the months started rolling by. And I started getting, oh, when am I going to get out of here? When am I gonna, and then, you know, you see people come. And there was a couple of people that came after me and got out before me. And I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. Whoa. How's that working? You know what I mean? How are they getting out before me? They ain't doing nothing no different than I am. But what I understood, I finally got out after almost about 9 months, almost about 8.5 to 9 months. But what I finally understood was that they were looking for you to get to that place where you were completely surrendered and you weren't concerned about all that stuff, about who's getting out first and all that kind of, you know, it was all about, they could tell. The counselors could tell when you were there. And it was when I finally let all that go up there that they finally said, okay, he's ready. And I ended up coming to Atlanta. That's how I ended up coming to Atlanta back in 1999. And I came here, had about a year sober from there, and stayed sober about another year, and relapsed again. And guess what I relapsed behind again? Her. You know? I got a track record. Michael laughs over there because we know we talk about this all the time. We talk almost on a daily basis, Mike and I. We talk about some of the things, the behaviors that I've exhibited. He speaks of his own, but the exhibits that I've exhibited over the years. And you know, and you know, I always have, you know, put the focus on the wrong thing, you know, and it's got me in trouble. So I relapsed with her, And this is where I hit my bottom, y'all. I ended up literally on the streets of Atlanta, homeless, eating out of garbage cans. Now, y'all got to think about that for a minute. Think about what I told y'all in the beginning, the family I came from. You know what I mean? I came from a really good family. You know, I mean, I can't tell y'all how horrifying of a feeling that was, knowing where I had come from, and to see myself literally going to run around, because, I mean, you know, you get hungry, you got to eat, and the only thing I knew to do late at night was to run around and see if I could find a box of cereal in somebody's garbage can or something. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, you talk about incomprehensible demoralization. That was it for me. That was my bottom, y'all. Jail wasn't my bottom. That was my bottom. And that was when I came back in this program the last time in December of 2002. And that's when I came in willing, so willing, like I said, and I got my sponsor. And these people already knew. These people knew me. And I remember when I came back, the one question a lot of them asked me was, what you going to do different this time? And my only answer was, I'll do whatever. I was over. I was done. I mean, I was like, you know, I can't do this anymore. My way's not working. And so I followed the instructions that the guys, you know, that my sponsor gave me, and I developed a network, which includes Michael. That's when I met Michael around that time, and have developed that, you know, did all the stuff that's outlined in this program, you know, and one of the things I was going to tell y'all about as far as recovery, there's a part in chapter 3 of the big book, More About Alcoholism, where it talks about I had to fully concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. See, there was times when I knew I had a problem. It was clear I had a problem with some other stuff, you know, but I used to try to convince myself that I didn't really have a problem with alcohol. You know, I tried to convince myself of that. And I proved that wrong. The New Year's Eve thing. That was one example. There was many other examples where I proved that wrong. Where I just tried to stay away from that and just drink alcohol, and the results were the same. And it was like an epiphany, man. I mean, you know, it was like clarity kind of finally set in with me, and I thought, you know what, George, you're an alcoholic, man. You're all that stuff, but you are also an alcoholic, you know. And Program of Alcoholics Anonymous has worked for me because it's not so much about the label I put on myself. It's about the fact that I have a disease where if I put any mood or mind-altering substance in my body, I am off to the races. It doesn't matter what it is, you know. I have an allergy, you know, and the only thing that works for me is complete abstinence, okay? So I did that. And just to share something with you, and Michael talked about this last week. I don't know if y'all were here when he shared his story last week, but I'm coming up on 14 years sobriety. And I don't use it. I say that not for any reason other than to let y'all know that you've seen how I bounced in and out of this program. You know what I mean? You've seen how, you know, I exhibited behavior like being real stubborn and thinking I knew more than the next, you know, than this person over here. And, you know, and I could do it. I can do this. Y'all don't need you to tell me how to do it. All that kind of stuff. Being victim and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? And, you know, in sobriety, there have been more adversity. I've gone through a lot of adversity since I've been sober this last time. I mean, you know, I went through a really horrible divorce about 3 years ago. I have a beautiful 6-year-old daughter out of it, though. You know what I mean? That's the godsend out of that bad relationship, you know. But going through that, and it's a lot of other things. I lost my dad at 3 years sober, you know, suddenly. I mean, it wasn't like he was sick. You know, he had an episode, and he was fixing. I know I get a phone call, he's gone. You know, and I had, you know, my dad and I were close, man. I loved him to death, man. He was one of my biggest supporters. You know, in fact, the last time I got sober, I remember him telling me, he said, this is the last time, right? Make this the last time. And I remember I hesitated for a second because I thought at that moment, I knew what my experience had been. You know, I don't want to make a promise to him that I can't keep, you know, but I said, yeah, I will, you know, because I don't know, I guess deep down inside, I knew that I was done, you know what I mean? And I've kept that, you know, I've kept that since then. But anyway, all this adversity I've been through, you know, You know, being sober, man, you learn how to be uncomfortable and walk through it. You see, my old way of handling uncomfortableness is to go escape from it. Drink, drug, whatever, you know, sex, whatever it is. Make me feel better. I want to feel better so I don't have to think about that. You know, but those are not fixes. Those are not solutions. You know, they're just whatever they are. it's destructive behavior a lot in a lot of ways. You know what I mean? The way I've learned to walk through the adversity is to be uncomfortable and walk through it and grow from it. You know, and I've learned so much in these last 14 years about me. You know, I've learned a lot about how, you know, to interact with other people and, you know, certain things to do and not do. You know, I still haven't been crowned with sainthood, y'all. I don't want to sit up here and try to pretend like I am. No, I mean, you know, I still make mistakes like anybody else, but I have learned a lot in sobriety. And my friend Russ Reddy talks about you ain't hit a bottom until you hit one in sobriety, you know, and I've hit some bottoms in sobriety, but you know what? If you don't give in to the usual thing that I would always do is go run to the drink or something else, you can grow through that experience, you know. And the good thing about it is you don't have to even do it by yourself. That's the beautiful thing about this program is that, you know, we got a room full of people in here right now, and you got people in here that care about you, you don't even know care about you. But if you're going through something and you let them know you're going through something, they'll rally around you. They'll rally around you. But you got to do your part. You got to do your part. So, you know, it's been an incredible journey for me. I mean, you know, y'all obviously see from my story how I, you know, I'm not a one white ship wonder. I'm not. You know, in fact, like I said, I first came the first time and didn't even care. Didn't even want to get sober, you know. And then when I did finally decide I wanted to really kind of start feeling like I wanted to get sober, you know, I still had that thinking that I knew better. You know, I got, you know, I know what's going on, man. You know, I'm a smart guy. I'm intelligent, man. I can figure this out. You know, no, this is one thing that doesn't work that way. You know, that's why they call us a we program, because, you know, we have to do this deal together. But, you know, I just want to thank Tom for inviting me up here. And I just want to say, guys, you know, to the lady who's here tonight coming back, glad you're here. Glad you're here. Stay. It's so much easier to stay than it is to come back. You know what I mean? And so thank you guys for letting me tell my story. I appreciate it.